I will read it again without editorial opinion. The Journey by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. We could probably read that at meetings, but fights would break out because it's not program approved, you know. But the instincts are sure real. So, self-acceptance, self-care, learning how to be of loving service to each other in ways that don't harm people. Are important parts. Letting God work. God who sows seed. God who is patient. God who has skills. God who seeks us out. Friendly. I was thinking, you know, that notion, I mentioned the parable yesterday about the shepherd looking for the lost sheep or the woman looking for the coin. Sometimes the impression given that the lost sheep and the coin are bad. They got lost after all. You know, bad coin, bad sheep. And some of us, when we think, well, God is looking at us because we're bad, you know. And that's not what it's about. The reason the shepherd looks for the lost sheep and the woman looks for the coin is because they're valuable. They're valuable. And the reason God seeks us is because we are valuable. We are treasures. We are that which God loves. So it's not scary being found by someone who treasures you. And that's real true as we even discover ourselves, you know, discover who we are and how we're put together. Rumi, I'll end with him, one of the lines of his poetry. He says, where there is ruin, R-U-I-N, where there is ruin, there may be treasure. There may be treasure. As many of us begin recovery in Al-Anon, what we see is ruin. Either we're the ruin or they're the ruin or someone else. But it's none. I don't know of anybody who joined Al-Anon because they were really happy people. Gee, I'm so happy I think I'll join Al-Anon. Most of us come in with a lot of numbness and exhaustion and pain. With some work, with some steps, with some people, we discover treasure. And the treasure is us. We're the treasure. If this is a room full of treasure, and you're here, your treasure too. So just keep that in mind. And why don't we end our weekend together? Lunch is in a while, but there's a bit of a delay on lunch. I'm sure that's for very important reasons. So we have some time, and a lot of us are very busy people. And I know some already have had to leave, and, you know, they need us down there so badly. What I would suggest for the 45 minutes or so before lunch is you take some time for yourself. Go for a slow walk. If you haven't been in the back property at up the hill, walk up. Just sit in the chapel for a while. Do some real, slow, peaceful things in God's nature for a while and soak in the love and the care and the skill that God gives us. Lots of times I cannot feel that. But when I can feel that, it helps the whole day. So that's my suggestion. Joni V.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. Why don't we end with the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back.
My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight, sober. Sober on a Saturday night always sounds odd to me. But I'm grateful for the invitation. It gives me a chance to visit my oldest brother and his wife, and visit with my niece who live not far from here, and see some old friends and meet new people. I live in Oakland, California. I've lived there since 1981. And I got sober in Berkeley. And I moved to Los Angeles and spent 4 years there. And with a little bit of time in the program and traveling around a little bit, you meet people all over that you've met before. And I think that's a good thing. So welcome here tonight if you're a new person, or if you're just visiting, you wonder how we do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to explain a little bit of it for you, because it's an odd group. A lot of places, for something like this, a fundraiser for central office, a lot of places, other organizations, other groups, get people with a lot of mental health to share. And we have found that not to be effective. Because we compare. And if someone who is totally serene and peaceful and well-organized and, you know, evolved, talks, you say, oh, I'll never match him, and you leave depressed. But if you have a lunatic share, you say, gee, I thought I was crazy, and then I heard the speaker. And I feel pretty good about my program, and that's how it works a lot. And so I'm not here as a role model. I'm not here as an answer person. I'm not here in any of those things. What I get to do is share experience, strength, and hope, and my own point of view. And I assure you, it's mine, and it might not be yours. And that's just fine. If you disagree with me on a major issue, you don't have to leave AA, and you don't have to throw me out of AA. And also, you don't have to tell me about it, just so you know that. You can just work it out with your sponsor later, you know. And I found one of the things I had to do to maintain some serenity was I had to give certain people permission to be wrong. They get to be wrong and breathe, just like the rest of us. And this was explained to me in part of the traditions. You're a member when you say you are. You know, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Period. Money, conformity, those aren't requirements. In the first edition of the book, they said the only requirement was an honest desire to stop drinking. And I have been to meetings where that was the topic. And the people who were holding forth on it were convinced that AA has been in the toilet ever since honesty was dropped as a requirement in the program. These were people with an axe to grind, and you'll find them at every meeting. And I reflected on that a little bit. Why did we drop the word honest? And I think we dropped the word honest because our experience is you do not need an honest desire to get sober. A sleazy desire to get sober is all that some of us come in with. Some of us come here with no desire to get sober. We hear the girls are cute, or we hear that there's free coffee. Really, let's go. Or the judge sends you. Or there's a lot of reasons, and we end up being sober. It's most surprising, any kind of desire. So that's when you remember. I also have been taught that every member owns one share of stock in the program. We're equal owners of this program. There are people who you'll hear criticize us, and they'll say AA is a cult, and we're not that well organized, I assure you. Although, I've been to meetings that ran like a cult. You know, one or two people dominated the meeting, and they'd have big issues like, what color should we paint the wall? And they'll discuss it for 4 months. And then the one or two people who claim 51% of the stock will do it their way. I mean, I've been to those meetings, but most of them aren't happy people by and large. Also, the highest rank you get in AA is sober. And whether you have 20 years or 20 days, same. I have heard old-timers talk nonsense and be complete jerks, and I have seen newcomers save lives. It's very odd if you go to a meeting and see what's going on. So that's what I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I travel a lot, and I regularly check in with AA wherever I travel, and it helps tremendously because I'm a little anxious, and I have a slight tendency to isolate, and I have a little tendency to be angry. And if I don't get to meetings regularly, those qualities take over. But if I check in with the meeting, it's just fine. I was in Taiwan in the past while, the island of Taiwan, the country of Taiwan, and I needed a meeting. And I went online, and sure enough, there was a meeting at a hospital, and I found out it was about a mile from where I lived, only they call it a kilometer, go figure, a couple kilometers. I said, what's that in miles? You know, real measurement. And and I went there, and I went to the wrong room, but I was on the right floor, and I was looking like I needed a meeting, and this guy walked by, a Western guy with a North American accent, and he said, are you here for the meeting? I said, yes! And he said, come on in. And there were a whole bunch of people talking Chinese, and he was talking Chinese with them. And then there was one other English-speaking guy there. And he said, why don't you two have a meeting in English, and we'll have a meeting in Chinese? And this guy I was talking with was also a traveler like me from South Africa and hadn't been to a meeting in about 6 weeks. I had only been 4 or 5 days, so I was much more spiritually evolved. And as our sober friends were talking away in Chinese, he told me his story and I told him my story, and I felt safe and connected. And then we ended the meeting with all of us saying the Serenity Prayer in Mandarin, which I thought was very advanced of me. A meeting. And I had to go a little bit out of my way to find it. And I don't like going out of my way, and I don't like feeling uncertain, and I don't like asking questions, and I don't like being lost. But I did that footwork, and it was a highlight of my time in that whole country. So I get to talk about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And that is the way we do things, at least where I go to meetings and where I got sober. We found out through trial and error, which is how we learn most things, that preaching to alcoholics doesn't help. Have you noticed that? Criticizing alcoholics doesn't help. Counseling alcoholics doesn't help. Cursing alcoholics doesn't help. Although those are four very fun activities to do. Bill Wilson, through trial and error, I mean, he's sober a short period of time and doesn't know what to do. He wants to help but doesn't know how. He goes into bars at night and talks to alcoholics who are drinking. And he'll start by saying, "The room filled with light." And after several months of this, he mentioned to his wife that no one wants to get sober. In the city of New York, I guess I'm a failure. And she said, "You're still sober." Which is the beginning of the tradition that the successful 12-step call is the one you leave sober. And then he talks with Dr. Silkworth, and Silkworth had dealt with a couple of thousand alcoholics before he met Bill Wilson, and he knew some things, what to do, what not to do, don't preach, don't nag, don't lecture, don't curse, don't counsel, you know. Talk about the disease, also don't mention, Bill, the room filling with light, because they'll just think you're nuts. Save that for their second and third birthday. But he said, talk about the disease of alcoholism, talk about allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, and then tell your story. So by the time Bill meets Dr. Bob in Akron, he's had a lot of trial and error. And by the time he meets Dr. Bob, he's not out to convert Dr. Bob. He's not out to save Dr. Bob. He just wants to stay sober. You know, Bob says, "What are you here for? What are you selling?" And Bill says, "I'm not here for you. I'm here for me." And he tells his story, and he talks about the disease of alcoholism. And then the two of them go meet AA member number 3, who's strapped down tight in some hospital bed. And they each tell their stories and talk about the disease of alcoholism. And the guy identifies with them. You know, they talk about crazy behavior. I've had some. They talk about crazy thinking. I've had some. They talk about awful things you did over and over and over again. Just trying harder. And he kept saying, "That's me. That's me. I drink like that." And then Bill and Bob continue their little show and tell. You know, this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. And the guy says, "I have no hope at all. You guys are somebody, but from what you tell me, there's no way out." And Bill and Bob laugh. Which is the first recorded instance of inappropriate AA humor. You're not supposed to laugh there. You're supposed to give him pity and $10 and, you know, buy him a meal. But they just laugh because they identify with the craziness. There's no way out. That's right. Doomed hopeless alcoholics. Hi! Come on in. Glad to see you. Oh, my. So that's how it works. Telling the stories. I was at my home group meeting in the last few years. My home group meeting is called Oakland Tuesday Night. It is in Oakland on Tuesday night, in case you're wondering. We were going to call it the Oakland Tuesday Night 6:30 meeting, just to take away all confusion. But we shortened it. And it's a one-hour meeting, and someone shares for 10 or 15 minutes, and then there's a discussion. That's how we do it, and we're very low-key. We don't even have cakes. We don't do chips. We don't do a lot of stuff. We just read some stuff and go on. So a few years ago, a young man came into the room. I'm 58. Anybody under 40 is a young man. This young man came into the room, and he was going to lead the meeting, and he said, "I'm not going to tell you my story." He said, "I'm going to tell you." And then he did this. "What the big book says." He did it just like that. Now, I'd been sober 25 years at that time, and I was instantly thirsty. It's the wrong tone of voice to use with anybody as sensitive as me. And I wanted a beer. I wanted to crack the beer. I wanted to drain the beer, staring him in the eye. Which indicates anger and resentment and all those things, which were there instantly. But I didn't. I stayed throughout the whole meeting, and I was lectured to and didn't have to drink. And, what it was like. What happened? What it's like now. If there's anything I say this evening that's helpful, please use it. And if there's stuff I say that's not helpful, don't worry about it. I was sober a couple of years. I want to salute, by the way, the central office volunteers and workers. It's one of the first kinds of service I did was check in with central office in Oakland and do stuff there. And when I moved to Los Angeles, I also checked into central office and did stuff there, answered the phones at central office and met people and talked to people. And it was a real important part of my recovery. Being of service, you know, and learning how to do things by doing them. What happened? What's it like now? I'm a daily drinker. I think I should mention that. I was told by somebody that if you're at an AA meeting and you're speaking, you should mention that you drank. And I want to let you know. I started drinking as a kid. I thought it was a great, it was energy, it was intelligence, it was life, it was passion. I loved it. I loved beer, I loved vodka, I loved all kinds of things, I liked the rituals of it. When I was very, very young, I drank. We had it around the house. And I liked the sweet of some of it. I liked drinking bourbon right out of the bottle and then taking a hit of Hershey syrup right out of the can, you know. Oh, my. That's a pretty sophisticated drink for a six-year-old, and it worked. And I also remember drinking cream de menthe or crème de menthe. Like, I never quite know how to pronounce it. But it's that green sugary stuff and right out of the bottle. And it was just bam! And I just thought that was a great way to perk up a morning. Garrison Keillor in one of his talks said that there's a special 12-step program for people who drink creme de menthe, you know, because it's so awful. That decent alcoholics won't let them into AA. It's such a disgusting drink. I drank in high school whenever I could. I was a nerd. I was a sissy. I liked reading books. I was not athletic. I looked very young for my age. I'm sure that's why I have a beard at this moment. But my voice changed late. And being a kid, I felt very awkward. And where do you put your hands? And what's going on? And I was bright, so I could distract myself with my brain. But I felt pretty lost a lot of times. Books were a great help to me, and they still are. Love to read. Whoever taught me to read, I'm very grateful for. But I would read a lot and feel very awkward, and I didn't feel very much like one of the guys. And I found out when I was 16, 17 years old, that I could drink guys three times my size under the table. This was wonderful. These were fellows who started shaving in the third grade, you know? And I was this skinny little white guy who could drink a six-pack of beer and a pint of vodka and continue to move, which is not the normal response to that amount of alcohol. When I was younger, I used to talk to high school kids. I was a high school teacher for a long time, but when I was in my 30s and sober, I would do some talking to high school kids, and I would tell them, you know, if you know somebody who can drink, a six-pack of beer and a pint of vodka, and they're still moving, you know, an alcoholic, and they all turn and look at Fred, you know. They all know who the alcoholics are. But I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I thought if I could hold my liquor, it meant that I had a lot of testosterone and I was very mature. I drank a lot, and I I had early symptoms of alcoholism. In high school, I had blackouts. You know, these continued throughout most of my 20s. I had blackouts and, you know, just not remembering stuff, driving in blackouts, having conversations in blackouts. I also had that the early experience of loss of control over personality. You know, we call it Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. By the way, if you're looking for something to read that's not conference approved, may I suggest Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. It is a step one story. There is no recovery in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And when Robert Louis Stevenson writes it, and at the same time Dickens is writing some of his stuff, mid-1800s, they believed that if you were drunk a lot and pretty much saturated in alcohol all the time, you could spontaneously combust. And that's what happens with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He spontaneously combusts. There's only ashes in this room. And the same thing happens to a couple of Dickens' more hideous characters. They just burst into flame and disappear. Well, Dr. Jekyll was the good guy, earnest, hardworking, idealistic. And then he played in the laboratory and used what he played in the laboratory with, and he became the monster, Mr. Hyde. And it's a real good description of how I was frequently. Most of the time, I was a gentle soul. But every so often, I would become the monster. And I'm not a physically violent man, but I was verbally violent. And I would use a lot of sarcasm and ridicule and attack. And I thought it was hilarious. Hilarious. Vast amounts of rage would come up, and I'd vomit my rage all over who was in front of me, and a lot of times I did that in blackout, so of course I didn't remember it the next day. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. There's a theory out that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is the way Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about his own cocaine usage, which is possible. I have no opinion on that outside controversial issue, but I find it interesting. I also had a pretty bad case of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, where I would drink and I could be dopey or grumpy or sleepy or happy. Occasionally I would turn into Snow White and feel very confused. I was sober a short period of time, a couple of months, and I got sober in Berkeley, and I didn't know anything about a lot of places, because at the end of my drinking, I'm not traveling. I'm staying in my room a lot because I'm falling down so frequently. So I didn't travel. Get sober, and I found out there's meetings in Berkeley. There's meetings in Oakland, all the way into Oakland. And there were meetings at a place called the El Cerrito Fellowship. El Cerrito? Where is El Cerrito? Well, there's the island of Alameda. There's a strip of Oakland. There's Emeryville. There's the rest of Oakland. There's Albany. And then there's El Cerrito. And that's how you find it. And way down San Pablo Avenue. And there was the El Cerrito Fellowship. And it was open a lot. Not 24 hours, but a lot. And there was frequently a meeting going on in there. And there frequently were crusty old-timers in there. You know, old guys in their 50s. And you could get to a meeting or you could talk to someone in recovery. And I went there and I didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not. I mean, I could just be crazy. That's always an option. I could just be going through a rough patch. That's always an option. I might just be unlucky for the last 12 years. That's also an option. So I went to this old guy and I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he said, Tom, I don't know if you're an alcoholic. Notice he would not diagnose me. I don't know if you're an alcoholic. He said, I know I'm an alcoholic. I said, how do you know? And he said, I know I'm an alcoholic because I cannot guarantee my behavior after my first drink. There are times I can drink a lot and nothing happened. No problems. I had that experience a lot. no problems. I'd get back, I'd be drunk, I'd be driving, that's not a problem. I'd get home, that's not a problem. I'd walk up the hill in Berkeley, I'd get to my own room, I'd go to sleep in my own bed, I would wake up the next morning, no vomit, no pee, success. Another great evening. Other times, though, I would drink just a little, and anything could happen. And I never knew which one it was going to be. Some people think that it's this. It's not how much you drink. It's not when you drink. It's not. Those aren't the questions. It's when you drink, what happens is the question. And for me, it was loss of control. Not always. But I never knew when it would happen. 1 out of 3 times, 1 out of 10 times, 1 out of 12 times. Loss of control. So, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, you betcha. I also, for a long time, had a big capacity to drink. I mentioned that earlier. I thought it meant that I was very masculine and mature. And I went through a change in my mid-20s where, like with a lot of us, instead of drinking a lot and having no impact, I would drink just a little and I'd be drunk. Terrifying to me. Again, more loss of control because I couldn't drink. I would get into trouble very quickly. I'm a falling down drunk. I'm a drunk driver. I would have mood changes. I'd get into trouble with my big fat mouth. And these would be in public places. And I'd get into trouble. And I'd be called before the boss. And there'd be questions like, well, what happened? And sometimes I'd remember and sometimes I didn't remember, but I had lots of fear and lots of anxiety, and I felt that I had a lot of secrets. And what I really wanted to do was control and enjoy my drinking. That was the most important thing on the map, and if I couldn't enjoy it, at least control it. And I did a lot of things. I think Howdy read the list. You know, switching from scotch to brandy. That's a great list. I've always wanted it calligraphied and handed out to newcomers. I did a lot of that stuff. I had a bad encounter one night in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue. I'd been out with a friend of mine. We visited a former student who was a student at Cal. And the kid brought out a bottle of vodka. My friend had a drink. The kid didn't drink, and I drank the bottle. This is a perfectly good evening for me. And I remember everything until we get the cold air, and then I'm blacked out for the next 3 hours, and I got very loud and violent, and I guess I tried to throw something through a big plate glass window on Telegraph Avenue and threatened to kill someone, and upset, you know, how sensitive we are. And the Berkeley police stopped me, and my friend, who had not yet been to enough Al-Anon, said, I'll walk him home. And it took him a couple of hours to get me across campus, and I kept lecturing people and warning them about any number of hideous diseases and awful political things happening in the United States. I kept on taking my clothes off and running around. Erratic behavior here. My friend got me to my house, and I wake up the next morning, and I don't remember any of that. But I know there's another blank space in the evening, and I called my friend, and I said, what happened last night? Now, he'd been to some Al-Anon. Not enough, but some. And he didn't want to lecture or preach or counsel or curse, but he knew that if you're asked a direct question by an alcoholic, you should respond with the truth. And he very simply said, what's the last thing you remember? I said, leaving Charlie's apartment. He said, oh, you don't remember the police. Let's start there. And then, without raising his voice or sounding, he just said, this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. And as the more he speaks, the more frightened I become. And here's my decision. I can't drink with people who know me anymore. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. So I went and I was also seeing a therapist named Dr. Arthur Solomon, who worked for Kaiser in San Francisco. Wise man, Dr. Solomon. And I went and we'd been talking about my drinking. Why do I drink like I drink? I mean, as we talked about stuff like they do. And I mentioned, I had an alcohol experience last night and maybe I should stop drinking. And he said, they thought that was a good idea. So I went for about 3 months without a drink. But I was completely obsessed with it. I'd wake up in the morning knowing I wasn't drinking. I'd go to class knowing I wasn't drinking. I'd have lunch knowing I wasn't drinking. Do more stuff, lie down, take a nap, walk around the block, fill in the time, gotta get to the end of the day, have dinner, watch the news, check my watch, it was 7:00 in the evening and I had 5 more hours of not drinking. This is not happy, joyous, and free. But it also is completely obsessed with drinking, not drinking. I mean, it's the only thing going on in my head. If anyone were to say, how are you doing? I would have said, I'm not drinking. How are you? Also, you can't talk about this with normal people. You know, they get very anxious when they get straight answers to some questions. So, a couple months pass. We're at an event. I was in the seminary at this time. I was at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley. It's 1974, 1975. We attended an ecumenical cocktail party at the Episcopal Seminary, the Church Divinity School of the Pacific. And they were passing around little tiny cheesy things. And sherry. I have no interest in sherry. But my friend, who had been with me a couple months before, was standing next to me, and the sherry tray came by, and he had a tiny little slip in Al-Anon, and he said to me, "You can't have that." Watch me. And I had one, I may have had two. He's horrified. And one of the things Dr. Bob says in his story in the big book, he says he was at the medical convention in Atlantic City and he bought some booze and he went up to his room to finish the job. And that's what I had to do. And I'm drinking for the next while. How do I get sober? I'm intervened on. I did not say, gee, I have trouble, I need help. My understanding was that I was just doomed. I'm good at the first step. I'm doomed. I had no sense that there was hope or a chance out or a way out of the trap at all. But my friends in the community knew about intervention and knew about treatment and knew about recovery because they had people in their families who had been through it. One of my pals, he'd just been at Hazleton I hadn't seen him in 5 or 6 years. He was in Hazleton. His mom and dad were getting sober. They did a whole family thing. He was in Hazleton for 6 months and came out and found me. And they just said, let's act on it. So I was intervened on, and I was put into a 21-day spin-dry program in Berkeley that was very AA-friendly, and they took us to meetings. And when I was intervened on, I'd like to just talk about that for a little bit. I had some friends of mine, and my boss was there. And he was new in his job, and I was his first alcoholic. So he was a little nervous. When they told me I was going into treatment, I felt relieved, big relief. I felt ashamed, because all I really wanted to do was beat this one, and I wasn't doing it. I felt embarrassed because they were in the room, but I was compliant. I said, yes, let's go, and I went into treatment, and about 4 months later, I got angry. And it took me 5 years to thank the people that saved my life. Lots of anger, angry about most things. I know they say, well, you shouldn't be angry. That's very helpful. But I'm angry a lot, and I need a program that helps me deal with my anger on a daily basis. So I want to talk about meetings for a second, then I want to talk about steps for just a little bit and my experience with this. I'm a lucky man because I liked meetings right away. I know people who don't. You know, when I was locked up there at the hospital, I went through the whatever that was, and then I became secretary of the hospital meeting. And secretary was also the cookie person and the setup person and the chairperson. I was the whole thing. So we set up the thing for our meeting, and I was 6 or 8 months sober, maybe 9 months sober. And the mom of one of my best friends from high school came into that treatment center. She did not recognize me because it had been 10 or 12 years since she had seen me, but I recognized her immediately. And I remember after, and she talked and she said something. I went up to her right after the meeting. I was so happy to see her. And I said, Mrs. So-and-so, it's Tom Weston. I'm Jamie's friend. How are you? And she looked at me and she just said, don't you hate these meetings? And no, I didn't hate these meetings. I found them to be fresh air. I found them to be oxygen. I found them to be life. I liked a lot of people I met at the meetings. I liked going to the meetings. I liked participating in the meetings. They helped, not a lot, but enough. You know, they gave me just enough help for that day. And I don't know what happened to her. I stayed in touch for a little bit, but then she wandered away. So meetings, I find them to be helpful. When I feel angry and isolated and overwhelmed, a meeting is a good place for me to be at. And I have found there are meetings in most places if I do a little footwork. And it helps a lot. But here's one of the things that's true. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you move anywhere, they don't do it right. And it's a crisis. Because how do they call themselves sober? Because they do this. And I found out there's, as the Japanese say, there are many roads up Mount Fuji. There's a lot of ways. I got sober in non-clapping AA. Non-clapping AA, depressed AA, dim light AA, where we basically quoted our therapists a lot and stayed sober. That's how I got sober. And then I moved to Southern California, where there are well-lit rooms and enthusiastic people and greeters at the door, which I could not have gotten into the room if there were greeters at the door when I what are they for? I was just a little, not so much agoraphobic, I just didn't like anybody. And I didn't want to have to meet you coming into the room. So I was in a shock going to meetings in L.A. where there were 100 people, 200 people, 300 people wearing dark glasses in well-lit rooms and calling each other darling. I found that to be very, very confusing. And I went to one big Sunday night meeting in central L.A., and a lot of people were there. And I'm now sober a year and a half. And I'm crazy. I'm brittle. I have moved. I'm not making friends. I don't know how to do this. And I don't know how to do small talk. And I was at this great big meeting in downtown L.A. at the Presbyterian Church on Wilshire in Normandy. All the smaller meetings closed down, and this was in 1977, 1978. And you had spectacular speakers. People you'd seen in movies and people you'd seen on TV, and they were talking there. And I heard some great stories of people describing stuff. And anyway, I also noticed 200-400 people in the room, and I'm not meeting anybody, that there were a dozen or so people who cleaned up after the meeting every Sunday night. So I had to think of a question, a small talk question, to meet somebody and say hello to. And I found this guy there who was very tall. And I said to him, trying to be cool and make friends, "Who are these people who are cleaning up?" And he said, "They're the ones who stay sober." Oh. I shoved someone out of the way and took their broom. And I started making a few friends. I also had a sponsor, but you know, what good are they when you don't know how to use them? I was in Berkeley. My sponsor was a wonderful man, a Vietnam vet, a little younger than me. We went to meetings together. He was safe. I wasn't safe with a lot of other males. He was good company. We spent time together. But then I was moving to L.A., which is so far away. And I wrote the Cardinal Archbishop, and I said, "Are there any sober priests in Los Angeles?" And he wrote me and said, "Welcome. When you get to town, call Terry R." So I got to town on a Friday. I went to a meeting Friday night, two on Saturday, two on Sunday. Called him Monday. "Hi, I'm new in town. I'm sober. The Cardinal gave me your phone number. I live only 2 miles from you. I need a sponsor." Now, I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know who he voted for. The big questions, you know. "I need a sponsor." And he said, "When did you get to town?" I said, "Friday." He said, "Have you been to a meeting?" I said, "I've been to 5. And he likes sponsoring desperate men, so he said, "Let's do it. I'd be happy to." And he picked me up that night, and he took me to... this is not a judgment. It's an observation. He took me to the dreariest meeting in North America, called the White Flag Men's Stag. And everyone sat around in a circle in the room, and everyone talked, and after everyone talked, everyone clapped. It's L.A., you know what I mean? And I just thought this was appalling. But I would go every Monday night, and I watched him interact with difficult, complicated people. And I learned a lot. And I went to that meeting a lot, and then I didn't go anymore, and then I went again, and then I didn't go anymore. But I started learning how to be with people. I finally asked my sponsor, you know, learning how to use a sponsor. I said, "I'm not making any friends here. I need smaller meetings. Are there any smaller meetings in Southern California?" And he said, "Go to a big book study." They are always small. I think it's the rule. I think it's in the bylaws. Big book studies, small group. And I started going to meetings in a Korean church on Friday night on Olympic Boulevard. And I was like 30, 31 years old. The women and men there, about 16 to 20 regulars, were in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they became my first friends. And it took me, with a lot of footwork and going to a lot of meetings, about 18 months to get used to the way they did it somewhere else. But I didn't have anywhere else to go. If I wasn't at a meeting, I was in my own head. And that's a very bad place to be. And I was there for a lot, and then I moved back to the Bay Area in 1981. My first day without a drink was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States. If that's not a clear day for you, I had to look it up again. It's August 16th of 1976. I think only Mr. Ford and I really remember that day clearly. I think Mrs. Ford was a little under the weather that evening. You know? You'd have to be. And I was 29 years old when I got sober, and I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that got sober. And I was sober a couple of months, and there were, right in the mid-1970s, a number of women and men in their 20s and 30s got sober. 5 years earlier, that wasn't so. But when I came in, a lot of people, a little older than me, a little younger than me, but my peers, came into recovery, and I'm grateful for that. And they had a meeting in Monterey that spring, 1977, the All-California Young People's AA event. And I wasn't going to go. I mean, I didn't go to rooms where there were a lot of people, thank you very much. But my sponsor went, and his sponsor, so a whole bunch of us went. And I thought I'd be one of the youngest people there. There were 1,000 people at this convention, and Friday night, what I noticed was that they had divided the room in half. I would have been on the older half. A lot of younger people. And the opening session on Friday night, they said, how many people are here tonight sober who are not yet of legal drinking age? And about 40 people stood up, and the place went wild. Great event for me. So I've been sober 29 years, and you'd think I'd be better by now, but I still get in my own way regularly. I think in my first, I want to talk about defects of character for just a few moments, and this is my hit on it. The language of the program says we ask to have our defects of character removed. I'd like to make a confession to you. Mine have not been removed. I said that somewhere once, and someone told me that if I did them right, they would be removed. And I said, thank you very much for sharing. That's an angry Al-Anon response. My experience, I go to Al-Anon too, by the way, I want you to know that. I was 3 years sober. I started going to Al-Anon because I did not want to be a sober person who was shooting people. And of course, the alcoholics are shooting whom? You know, well. Enraged and exhausted. And I'm very grateful for that program. So, the defects of character. My experience is not that they've been removed, but rather I have a daily reprieve. That rings more true to me, and your experience may be different. And when I did my fourth and fifth step, I wrote about resentments, fears, sexual stuff, and finances, like it's done in the big book bills thing there and in the 12 and 12, and I followed that. I was sober maybe 20 years, and I was somewhere, and I like the stories in the back of the book. I know that's controversial to say, but I really like the stories in the back of the book. And I was reading in the third edition the first guy from Chicago who gets sober. And as you know, Chicago drunks are bad drunks. Page 292 in the third edition, it's the short story called He Sold Himself Short. And he leaves Chicago, he hooks up with Dr. Bob, he spends time with Dr. Bob, and it's like 1937, 1938, nothing's written down, it's all word of mouth. And he says, I stayed in Akron 2 or 3 weeks on my initial trip, trying to absorb as much of the program and philosophy as possible. I spent a great deal of time with Dr. Bob whenever he had the time to spare, and in the homes of 2 or 3 other people trying to see how the family lived the program. You know, it's not what they say, what are they doing? Not what they're saying, what they're doing. Every evening we would meet at the home of one of the members and have coffee and donuts and spend a social evening. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, a Wednesday and Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. The 6 steps were, 1, complete deflation. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power. 3, moral inventory. 4, confession. 5, restitution. 6, continued work with other alcoholics. Now you can see that 12 come from 6. Bill will write about those, and I guess in 20 minutes, half an hour, he comes up with 12 steps. Dr. Bob led me through all of these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up some of my bad personality traits. Now, haven't you ever wanted to do that with someone you sponsor? Before they say anything, you want to say, here's what I notice. There's a rule here, a little bit of psychology 101, but I think it's true. If I notice something in you, and it bothers me a lot, there's a chance that I'm personally familiar with that. That's not always true, but it's true a lot. I was somewhere talking. I thought I was giving an okay talk. At the end of it, this person came up livid, vibrating, and said, you're so... Yes. I mean, others have noticed, you know. I mean, this is... And what I wanted to say was, are you identifying or comparing? You know, I mean, I made her real mad. So my suspicion is that Dr. Bob is looking in this guy and seeing some of his own stuff. Right? He brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. I'll repeat the list. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, resentments, page 292, third edition. Now, those are mine. Those are mine. And my experience is daily reprieve. I wish I weren't as careless as I am, but I'm careless. I mishear things, I misjudge things, I misinterpret things. I misplace things. You know, I mean, and I'm trying to be a good citizen, but I know the letter's here somewhere. I know the check is here somewhere. I'm sure I wrote down this conversation somewhere. You know? Intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, resentments. If I skip meetings, cut corners, don't pay attention to too hungry, too angry, too lonely, too tired. If I don't do some kind of regular prayer and meditation, there are several other things I need to do. If I cut back on any of those, my selfishness, my conceit, my jealousy, my carelessness, my intolerance, my ill temper, my sarcasm and resentments form in groups of 2 and 3 and ambush me. And I am sometimes caught completely by surprise by this, but it's nothing new, and what I have to do is a 10th step. When wrong, promptly admitting it. And I think in my first 10 years sober, I maybe did a 10th step 10 times. But it's a regular part of my program these days. I mean, I'm wrong a lot. And I tell this to people and they think I'm kidding. No, this is not humility. This is the truth. I was ordained a priest in 1978, and I'm in active ministry now, and I'm glad for that, and I get to do a lot of stuff with drunks. And when I'm with church people, I'll tell them, I'm wrong a lot. You need to know that. I've been to school forever, but I'm wrong a lot. And is there an example? Example number one. I was sure, 100% sure, that the next pope was going to be Italian. And I mentioned that to everybody who would listen for the last 5 years. And then they do it differently. And I look like a fool. You know? That's right. Fallible. Make lots of mistakes. And what the program tells me to do is, when I make mistakes, not if, when I make mistakes, promptly admit it, and then clean up the mess, clean up the mess, clean up the mess. And I'm cleaning up messes a lot. And that's just in the ordinary part of being alive. This is a program that works for me because I am flawed with a short memory span. And I have to constantly remind myself to do the simplest things, like keep it simple. Day at a time. Easy does it. I think those are deeply profound. I sponsor a couple of people who, through email, which I like doing, actually. And because you don't have to see them. I know that sounds harsh. Can I see you? It's going to be 3 hours of me, 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 me. How about sending me a nice email? And there are always these involved relationship things, and I sometimes thought I should have a yellow chart. They first marriage. I say, oh, God, and kids, and you have this big National Security Administration-like chart, you know. Okay, A, B, C, A, B, C, A, B. And I get these word after word after sentence and complication and intensity. And I love reading something like that, skimming it, and sending back. Day at a time. Send. Or live and let live. Send. I think that's an art form. Oh, my. But yeah, the making mistakes. I'm not afraid to admit it. And I know people who are terrified. It really helps me to have a program where I can admit I was wrong a lot, instead of defending myself. You know? And I'm a little suspicious of people who can't admit they're wrong. And I've never made a mistake. Oh, perhaps one, oh, years ago. Well, we're not going to be friends. Oh, my. I want to talk for just, time's running and you all have to get home, and I know there's a lot to do at home. Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, stuff. But I do want to just talk something that Dr. Gill told me years and years and years ago about alcoholism, and I found it helpful. And he says, Dr. Gill is still sober. He's still alive. He's still sober. He's in his 80s. He's very frail. He got sober during the Eisenhower presidency. And in San Francisco and Marin County, he has helped hundreds, if not thousands, of people get well. God bless Dr. Gill. And I heard him talk about alcoholism. And he described it this way. He said, alcoholism is a disease that has three distinct phases to it. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when it's fun. Phase two, fun plus problems. It's still fun, but you start to have problems. Phase three, problems. The good times are gone. Now, that's right. I had fun for a long time. If I could still have fun, I'd still be doing it. But I was no longer having fun, and I couldn't stop doing it. So the second brief story about the disease. Someone in the East Bay said that alcoholism is a lot like dancing with a gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. And this is about that lack of control. And you know how alcoholics think, you know, the gorilla's cute, you're getting along, you're having a pretty good time. The gorilla's a hell of a dancer, this is sensational. You might get lucky later on. I mean, who knows these things, but that's how you're thinking, manipulating, planning, scheming. And you don't know you're in trouble until you want to sit down and the gorilla won't let you. And then later on, the gorilla wants to tango, and you say you don't know how, and the gorilla doesn't care. You tango. You end up doing a lot of things you never thought you'd do, and the gorilla is making those decisions. Now, the gorilla kills a lot of us. I started noticing that a lot when I was about 10 years clean and sober. A lot of women and men who should be in the rooms, but they danced one more time with the gorilla and they never got back. They suicided, they overdosed, there were car crashes, there were motorcycle crashes, there were strokes, that people choked on their own vomit. Lots of things that happen in recovery. If you're clean and sober today, it's a pretty good sign that the gorilla has let go. If the gorilla has let go, you want to get out of the cage. And you don't want to go back into the cage, even if the gorilla starts humming your song, which it does. Oh, I'm sure I'll do better this time. I've learned a few new steps, you know. People who love us, they walk by the cage and they see us dancing with the gorilla and they go crazy. And so they break into the cage and they try to get between us and the gorilla to save us. And the gorilla yanks their arms and legs off. So they have a program too. And it's called Al-Anon. And a lot of Al-Anon comes down to stay out of the cage. We don't need more casualties. You see? We don't need more casualties. But I feel so awful. Well, talk to us. We all do. We'll talk. But going into the cage doesn't help anyone. Well, but this time it'll be... Yes, it won't be different. You know, stay out. Step three, we talk about God as we understand God, and I understand God differently today than I did 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago. Understanding is different for me, and part of my understanding is I get to ask questions, and I get to have doubts, and I get to wonder how any of this thing works. I've got some faith. But sometimes I'm not sure what I believe, and I have to ask other people, what do we believe? And they have to start from the very beginning and remind me of real basic things. There's a moment in the New Testament where someone comes up to Jesus. People frequently are coming up to Jesus in the New Testament. And ask them something, and Jesus says, do you believe? And the person says, yeah, I believe. Help my unbelief. And I think that's a pretty good prayer. I believe some. Help me believe more. And sometimes I'm not so sure about any of those things. But faith for me, I have some belief. And the real problem for me in recovery hasn't been faith. It's been hope. I believe, you know, I'll sign the Nicene Creed. You bet. You know, I can do it in three languages. Happy to do it. I believe. But I had no hope. I had no hope that recovery would work for anyone as badly wired as I was. I thought it would work for you because you are sincere, simple people. Well-intentioned, you know. I'm angry, I'm cynical, I'm burned out, leave me alone, I don't like you all that much, and if I just could try harder, I could think about it and solve my problems. I just didn't think that it would work for me too, and I was going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings, And when I was 6 or 8 or 10 months sober, somewhere in very early recovery, one morning I was at a meeting and I had a little bit of hope. Not a lot, a little bit of hope. I realized that I was not the only person in the room. Big realization. And I realized that anybody in the room had access to recovery. And I was in the room. And that changed everything. I ask, my first morning meditation is in the shower. I don't think I believe anything until I've been in the shower for a few minutes. And then I ask God for help, and I ask God to give me enough hope for today, enough faith for today, enough kindness for today, enough justice for today. Give me enough, and then I can begin my day, and I do some other things to help and get me focused and get me moving. But I ask. And then my experience sometimes by the end of the day is they're all used up. It's 10 p.m. I come back to my room and the light's flashing. Messages on the machine. Should I answer these or not? It might be better if I call them after a good night's sleep. Because right now I hate everybody. And I would just tell them to drink or jump off the bridge. So I don't think it's good to return the call now. And I hope there are other people out there they can talk to. As one of my Baptist friends in Texas says, there's one source for all life and all recovery, the higher power. And there are many channels, and channels change all the time. And there are other channels beside me that can help people. Final point, I just heard this year, and I liked it a lot. I was somewhere, and they were talking about higher power. And this other sober priest, he started talking about he's so glad he has a higher power because he spent years serving lower powers. And he doesn't want to serve lower powers anymore. He wants to be connected to a higher power. And I thought that was genius. You know, simplifies my life a lot. I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be here. If there's anything this evening that's been helpful, please use it. If it hasn't been helpful, don't worry about it. When I was newly sober, one of the first places I ever talked at, I was 2 or 3 years sober, was in Pasadena. And I thought I gave an okay talk, but probably a little full of self and a little arrogant. Anyway, I was answering phones at Central Office in Los Angeles that next Tuesday night. Me and a fellow named Tom Bush, he died sober. He drank himself off the Los Angeles Times, which takes some doing. And we'd answer the phones together, and we became very good friends, although we had nothing in common. Over the years, and anyway, this person called, and they were very upset, and they were drunk a little, and I put on my counselor hat and my counselor voice, and making the cooing sound, you know, and I asked if this person had ever been to AA, and she said, "Oh yeah, I was at a meeting Sunday night in Pasadena," and I said, "You know, well, at whatever church it was," and I said, "Well, I was the speaker." And she paused and said, "You were that twit?" So if that's your response to this evening's sharing, get to other meetings. I assure you there are people who disagree with me on everything and do it very differently, and you can connect with them. Go to meetings until you like going to meetings. Go to meetings until you hear your story told. Go to meetings until you can be helpful. Go to meetings to say hello to new people. Go to meetings to say hello to travelers and strangers and folks new in town. You can give them all your phone numbers. I assure you they won't call. But you can give your phone numbers and that service. And what we do a lot of times in recovery is we who are travelers and pilgrims, we find safe places, and we find safe people. And that helps change the world. Thanks for being here tonight.